This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says it informed the IAEA of new construction around Natanz facility as part of measures to bolster security around the country's nuclear sites. The Russian president says his country has weathered a blitzkrieg of Western sanctions and that the era of the unipolar world has ended. And Julian Assange's brother says an appeal against the UK decision to extradite the WikiLeaks founder to the United States will include information about a CIA assassination plot. Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran says it's already informed the International Atomic Energy Agency of new construction around the Natanz nuclear facility. Spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says it is moving a centrifuge manufacturing plant to a site near Natanz for security purposes. Behruz Kamalvandi says that relocation is part of measures to tighten security around nuclear sites. They come after terrorist operation that damaged a centrifuge plant in Karaj last year. Earlier, the New York Times reported that Iran is constructing new facilities deep under mountains that are able to withstand bunker-busting bombs and cyber attacks. A U.S. think tank says Israel's strategy on Iran has been a total failure, warning Tehran's sharp response to the regime's provocations could spark a regional confrontation. In an article on its website, the Atlantic Council said there is a growing gap between statements of senior Israeli officials and reality on the ground. It said a recent report by the UN's Atomic Agency reveals the depth of Iran's progress in its nuclear program, despite Israel's efforts to thwart it. The futile endeavors include various covert operations, such as sabotage and assassinations, and a threat to bomb Iran's nuclear installations. Peace also said Iran's oil revenues under current sanctions regime illustrate failure of the Israeli-backed U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. Journalist and political analyst Sayed Mohsen Abbas joined us earlier. He said that Israeli belligerence has resulted in a more powerful and advanced Iran.
I think it's been an abject failure, quite clearly, in spite of the fact that they have had the ability to occasionally assassinate in cold blood scientists, you know, Mohsin Fakhrizadeh being the most prominent. They've had the audacity to also reach out and basically target kill Hassan Saeed Khodai, an IRGC officer who was in charge of missiles. Programs. And so, of course, what they're doing is they're extending their exceptionalism that they have to go out and assassinate and kill Iranians wherever and whenever they wish. Of course, Qasem Soleimani, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, was the prime case of that happening as well. However, what has it achieved? Everything Israel has done in terms of trying to eradicate Iran's ability, its national sovereign right, in fact, to self-defense through missiles programs, through nuclear energy even. All of these things are part of the norm of the civilized world. But what has Israel achieved by all this? In fact, they've just accelerated, first of all, the process of Iran's commitment to increasing its security power, its military and technology power. They've accelerated Iran's necessity to defend its borders, and Iran is very capable of doing that through asymmetric warfare, which was something which the Israelis and the Zionist American alliance did for many, many years before. And the Iranians' Quds Force, the IRGC's Quds Force, has achieved huge victories on every arena that it's come up against the Zio Western imperialist empire. So, in fact, everything that they've been doing has just backfired constantly. And even cyber attacks, Iran is able to give pound-for-pound responses. And they have been doing this.
Palestinians are once again laying to rest their loved ones killed by Israeli forces. This time, the funeral is for three men fatally shot in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin.
It's a huge crime. They could have avoided killing them. They could have fired at the car wheels. This is a crime. God is great. May God avenge them.
The men lost their lives immediately after Israeli troops opened fire on their car. At least 12 Palestinians were also wounded in ensuing clashes. The resistance movement Hamas says Israel will pay for its crimes. It also says that Israeli measures only strengthen Palestinians' resolve to continue their resistance against the regime. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has also reacted. It called on the International Criminal Court to investigate crimes committed by Israeli forces and settlers. Israel has in recent months intensified attacks in occupied territories. Jenin is the hardest hit following a series of anti-Israel operations by Palestinians. The Palestinian Health Ministry says more than 60 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces this year, many of them in raids. Political analyst Barry Grossman believes Palestinians have the right to fight Israeli occupation and they should be supported in their struggle.
It's not for us to dictate to Palestinians how they should resolve their situation. We can provide support, but they must take the lead. And I would suggest a good starting place might be to make clear whether or not the Palestinian Authority actually does represent Palestinians. After that, I certainly would like to see a lot more solidarity amongst Palestinian resistance groups and indeed with Hezbollah and like-minded nations in the region to take the fight to those military forces in occupied Palestine that are responsible for not only murdering countless numbers of innocent Palestinians, but usurping Palestinian land. And all we can do is provide support for that. But I think it's high time for the Palestinian leadership itself to make clear what its relationship is with the Palestinian Authority, where the accords negotiated many years ago, the Oslo Accords, leave things, because in my mind, it's high time that Palestinians made it clear that they renounce those accords as a result of the occupation's continuing breach of those accords.
Israel has carried out new incursions into the Gaza Strip. Regime drones have fired a rocket into northern Gaza. Tanks have also shot several shells. Earlier, we contacted our Gaza correspondent for some details.
Israeli drone fired at least one rocket at an area in the northern Gaza Strip, a town of Beit Hanun, close to the security fence with the occupied Palestinian lands. And also Israeli tanks fired several shells towards the same area. According to witnesses, the attacks happened after an Israeli spy balloon fell on the ground on Beit Hanun, and Israeli regime forces tried to hit it, and some Israeli army special forces tried to enter the area, but they were chased away by Hamas resistance fighters in Beit Hanun. Meanwhile, the Hamas military fighters managed to retrieve sensitive equipment and highly advanced equipment and cameras from that spy balloon that fell in northern Gaza. Today's airstrikes were the first airstrikes to hit Gaza for almost 40 days now. Some here believe that Israel is trying to escalate the situation. while they were saying that the balloon was not that important for the Israeli regime, but if it was so, why did the Israeli forces try to enter the area in northern Gaza, and why did they hit it with drone rocket and tank shells?
U.S. President shrugs off criticism over an upcoming meeting with a Saudi crown prince on the sidelines of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council summit, despite the kingdom's poor human rights record.
The same way I've been handling it. I'm not going to meet with MBS. I'm going to an international meeting, and he's going to be part of it, just like there were people part of the discussion today.
The Saudis, however, say that Biden will hold a one-on-one meeting with Mohammed bin Salman during his planned trip to Riyadh this July. U.S. lawmakers, including some Democrats, have criticized the visit, citing his promise to put human rights at the heart of his foreign policy. Rights advocates also say that Biden's trip could embolden Saudi Arabia to crack down on dissidents abroad and restrict civil liberties domestically. Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported Palestinian leadership informed the U.S. administration of its refusal to hold a Palestinian-Israeli meeting during a planned visit of the U.S. President Joe Biden to the region as long as Israeli occupation will not recognize the so-called two-state solution. Our correspondent Mona Kandil reports out of Ramallah.
Ahead of a planned visit by U.S. President Joe Biden to the region next month, Israeli media revealed that the American administration had raised the possibility of holding a meeting between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, but the Palestinians have rejected the idea. According to the Israeli daily Haaretz, the Palestinians informed the Americans that they would only accept such a meeting if all parties agreed on advancing a two-state solution based on the 1967 borders.
The Biden administration, with its offer to have a kind of a meeting between the Palestinians and the Israelis, is trying just to get out of the hook. It's trying to say that they are interested in doing something in the area. At the same time, what they are offering is just a kind of arrangements, economic arrangements, make life a little bit much better under the occupation. Now, the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinians in general are aiming at ending the occupation and establishing a Palestinian state.
The Palestinians, however, want from the Americans to reopen the U.S. consulate in East Al-Quds and to remove the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, from the U.S. terror list. These demands had been made during a meeting between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs Barbara Leaf in Ramallah.
Biden's visit carries with it many risks, including shaping the situation in the region in favor of U.S. interests and those of Israel. We have demanded from the U.S. some issues that it can make unilaterally and don't require hollow meetings. It's clear the U.S. will be ignoring the major cause, which is the Palestinian cause.
On Tuesday, the White House confirmed Biden's first trip to West Asia region next month, during which he will visit the occupied Palestine, followed by a trip to Saudi Arabia. Israel's foreign minister has said that his country was looking to Biden's trip next month to help improve relations with Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden is planning a visit to Saudi Arabia as part of the Riyadh summit. Biden says he will be focusing on Israel as a key issue for talks during his Saudi visit. Palestinians, on the other hand, say the Biden's visit to the region would only be symbolic. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The U.S. and its Western allies have imposed tough economic sanctions on Russia over the Ukraine conflict. President Vladimir Putin says these sanctions have failed to achieve their goals, though.
The sanctions are crazy and, I would say, reckless. The quantity and the speed at which they were signed off was unprecedented. The West's plans were plain to see, to hurriedly and forcefully crush the Russian economy by destroying business chains, forcing the recall of Western companies from the Russian market, freezing Russian assets, hitting the Russian industry, finance, people's quality of life. They failed.
Putin said Russia's economy has weathered a blitzkrieg of Western sanctions. He said the European Union imposed sanctions against Russia on orders from the White House despite damage to its own economy. Putin said the EU has completely lost its political sovereignty. He also denounced the U.S. as a declining power that treats its allies as colonies. Russian president said the era of a unipolar world has ended. And the Russian president has also warned Ukraine will turn into a semi-colony of Western countries if it goes ahead with joining the European Union.
The Ukrainian economy is structured in such a way that it requires very large subsidies and aid. And if it does not protect the international market, it will end up becoming a kind of semi-colony. This is my opinion. But at the same time, Ukraine will receive a lot of support for current expenses.
Vladimir Putin issued the warning after the European Commission recommended giving Ukraine a candidate status for joining the EU. Putin, however, said that Moscow is nothing against the country's possible membership into the bloc. The Russian Foreign Ministry also accused the EU of manipulating Ukraine over its membership bid. Kiev's push is backed by the French, German, and Italian leaders, but launching accession talks requires unanimous approval from all EU member countries. Leaders of the 27-nation bloc are set to discuss the matter at an upcoming summit in Brussels next week. Now, new information will be submitted to the court as WikiLeaks appeals UK's decision to extradite organization's founder, Julian Assange, to the United States. Assange's brother says evidence includes a CIA plot to kidnap and assassinate the WikiLeaks founder, and now his lawyers are subject to espionage. The abduction and assassination were reportedly plotted when Assange was holed up at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. He is currently held in a prison in London still. Washington wants to put Assange on trial for the publication of confidential files in 2010 and 2011. They revealed how U.S.-led forces killed civilians in unreported incidents in Iraq and Afghanistan. WikiLeaks has called the U.K. government's decision to approve the extradition a dark day for the freedom of the press and for British democracy. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
In truth, AFRICOM fights yesterday's wars tomorrow. As U.S. forces intensify local conflicts and militarism, they sow the seeds of future crises. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jonathan N.G. Arthur. This article is published under the heading, Covert U.S. Operations in Africa are Sowing the Seeds of Future Crises. Stay tuned for more. This March, Malian forces attacked Moura, a small sun-baked town in the middle of the country. The operation began on a market day, as locals streamed into the area with their livestock. Residents recall hearing helicopters slash the air and soldiers disembark with grim resolve. Malian forces laid siege to the village for multiple days, reportedly slaughtering civilians and wreathing corpses in flames. In a clinically worded communique, the government announced that army completed a systematic cleaning of the zone with very precise intelligence, killing 203 militants. Immediately, investigators contested its account, Human Rights Watch labeling the operation the worst atrocity in Mali's decade-long armed conflict. Estimates of civilian deaths range as high as 500. Another episode in a litany of atrocities. The United Nations has urged investigation of the latest scandal in Mali's war against militants. Yet the massacre also signifies the failure of the United States policy as Mali occupies the center of U.S. strategy in Sahel region. Since 2007, U.S. Africa Command, that is AFRICOM, has vigorously partnered with the states to combat militants, bolster influence, and check competitions there. Rather than secure peace, U.S. intervention has internationalized local conflicts, deepened social divisions, and fostered militarism. Its failure has profound roots. Malian crisis and other conflicts are inseparable from a cascading history of U.S. interventionism in Africa. African policy directly builds on the Cold War. After the Second World War, the U.S. discreetly promoted Western retrenchment in Africa. Officials helped Europeans reassert colonial mastery in order to forge a unified capitalist bloc and support for North Atlantic Treaty Organization. They notably armed France during its bitter war in Algeria, which became emblematic struggle for colonialism. But as the conflict drained Western legitimacy, U.S. policymakers encouraged Europeans to substitute informal hegemony for territorial occupation. Paradoxically, a new imperial order emerged with decolonization. Western capitals maintained effective sovereignty through a balance of soft and hard power. The haze of ideology, capital markets, political pressure, military bases, and other tools that could plunge a former colony into chaos. Lacking comparable tools in Africa, the U.S. initially outsourced imperialism to European allies. Yet gradually, the U.S. cast a searing shadow backing coups to smother radicalism, open markets, and combat influence. The The Democratic Republic of Congo first felt its weight in 1960. U.S. officials regarded the country as a subterranean treasure trove brimming with strategic minerals. Yet they viewed its first prime minister, Patrice Lumumba, with acute anxiety. Lumumba refused to accept Western hegemony while celebrating Congolese independence as a decisive step towards the liberation of the entire African continent. President Dwight Eisenhower wished he would fall into a river full of crocodiles. That summer, he schemed to assassinate Lumumba and install a pliant substitute. The CIA deemed his removal an urgent and prime objective. Eventually, secessionists compelled Lumumba to request UN intervention. Yet, as the historian Elizabeth Schmidt observes, the operation was largely an American affair. The U.S. ferried UN troops to the Congo while snatching power from Lumumba. After he thwarted their grasp, the CIA helped local officials apprehend him. They handed Lumumba over to secessionists, who brutally murdered him before an approving audience of Western observers. Lumumba's assassination was a cruel premonition. In following years, U.S. leaders ruthlessly eliminated exponents of African liberation. They especially targeted Kwame Nkrumah, an elegant colossus of Pan-Africanism. After Lumumba fell, Nkrumah warned that neocolonialism threatened to subvert African independence, reducing states to shells directed from outside. Nkrumah turned Ghana into a bastion of revolution, offering safe haven to anti-colonial movements and inspiring U.S. civil rights activists. In response, the U.S. State Department froze loans and depressed global prices, throttling Ghana's economy. Officers finally struck in February 1966. U.S. officials gloated that the new military government was almost pathetically pro-Western. In 1957, Ghana's liberation was the symbolic catalyst of African independence, lending decolonization an irresistible air of inevitability. By contrast, Nkrumah's downfall solidified an ominous trend toward military rule. Before 1965, coups were relatively rare. Within less than two decades, military leaders governed 40% of Africa. Ultimately, U.S. strategy curbed the promise of independence and accelerated the drift toward militarism, while carving the continent into invisible yet enduring spheres of influence. Repeatedly, U.S. partners waged catastrophic proxy wars across the region. Nkrumah's critique of neocolonialism proved prophetic. For those who practice it, it means power without responsibility, and for those who suffer from it, it means exploitation without redress. In 2020, the elaborate defense system imploded. That August, another U.S.-trained officer, Colonel Assimi Goïta, seized office in the Malian capital of Bamako, again citing the security crisis. His power grab initiated a wave of six groups in five countries within 2 years, immersing Mali, Chad, Guinea, Sudan, and Burkina Faso in chaos. AFRICOM had trained many of the plotters. In Guinea, local forces paused an exercise with U.S. Army Green Berets to storm the capital. Most coup leaders cited the threat of militants and poor governance, crises that AFRICOM had not solved but aggravated. Before 2001, U.S. officials registered no terrorist organizations in sub-Saharan Africa. By 2019, they tallied nearly 50. For years, AFRICOM had inflamed long-standing local conflicts, wrenching societies apart and lending militants meaning. And now, in a reverse domino effect, the very forces it enlisted to fight were rebelling. Tensions with Mali have compelled Western forces to scale back operations. This February, France announced troop withdrawals, while waning confidence in the West prompted local authorities to hire mercenaries. African Commander General Stephen Townsend warned that the decision would conclude in horrific violence against Africans. 2 weeks later, the Moro massacre unfolded. In the resulting fallout, Mali dissolved defense agreements with European allies this May while accusing France of espionage. The military junta then abandoned the G5 Sahel, prompting President Mohamed Bazoum of Niger to announce that the region's main security organization was dead. UN forces remain in Mali, sustaining heavy losses, investigating an exponential increase in human rights violations and defending an abrasive government that lacks control over the majority of its territory. Meanwhile, the UN warns that 18 million residents in the Sahel face severe hunger as war and famine sweep through the region. Yet the mounting crisis also implicates the U.S. AFRICOM regards itself as invisibly sleek and deadly effective, an elite force that fights tomorrow's wars today. But in practice, operations resemble previous neo-colonial interventions, fostering military rule and human rights violations. In truth, AFRICOM fights yesterday's wars tomorrow. As U.S. forces intensify local conflicts and militarism, they sow the seeds of future crises.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, and I am your humble host, Zainab. We are again at your service with yet brand new episode of Back to Reality. Yes. Today we are going to talk about what aging teaches us. And on that note, we have in studio with us two special guests. I have with me Fatima from California and Sadiqa from the UK. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for inviting me. This is Fatima from California, USA.
Oh, alaikum salam. Thank you for having me over. And this is Sadiqa from UK.
Thank you so much, guys, for joining us. A very warm welcome. They say that with age comes wisdom. Fatima, let's start from you. What do you think? How true is that?
Yeah, I think the older we get, the more life experiences we have.
All right.
Helps us get more wisdom on different topics.
What and have you learned from aging?
Less testing each one of us in different ways. So the best way to deal with the life problems and getting more wisdom is to trust in Allah more and just know that we're not alone. We always have Allah and Imam Zaman al-Islam with us.
All right.
And not to have too much high expectations from people. I think when you're younger, you have, especially me, I had such a positive and like, okay, everybody's so nice and good when they're not. So then you have to just be aware, like, not everyone is trying to have the best intentions for you and just not to have like a high expectation of anyone. Kind of be independent, like be more independent, I think.
All right. So you're trying to say as we age, we learn who to rely upon. You said that's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah, obviously. Yeah. And who to rely among imam of your time. And you get to know who is a true person, who is a fake person. And you get to know a lot of things. You stop expecting from people. Siddiqa, what's your take on that?
So I do agree with Sister Fatima on this, that yes, growing up, aging does teach us a lot of experience. But it depends on how we use what the experience that we have gained.
Yeah.
So someone might have one experience, but if they're not able to act on it and not able to learn from it, then that experience is basically futile. It doesn't serve them any purpose.
True.
And from an Islamic perspective, when we are looking at other people in a society, because obviously we do live in a society, we are taught that one of the greatest signs of a believer is to be humble.
Yeah.
And one of those ways of remembering to be humble is that when you see an older person, you know that they have been given a greater chance. They have spent more of their life in worshipping Allah. They've spent more of their life in learning and experiencing different things. So obviously the worship of Allah. So when we see an older person, that means they have been given a greater chance to worship Allah. But it comes down to the same thing. Were they able to practice it? Mm-hmm. Or was it just age is just a number for them and not a chance to progress? Because the end goal of our life is perfection. We are supposed to gain perfection. We're supposed to attain perfection.
Yeah.
But if age is just a number where a person goes through this whole life without really understanding their purpose in life, now again, it's just been days and nights have just passed for them.
The more they age, they become more reliable on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Like getting older, they start doing more ibadah. And in one of the narrations, we have that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves the ibadah of young person, the ibadah of then a 2 unit of prayers of a young person is much better than 1,000 unit prayers of an old person. Why do you think so?
And so basically my opinion or what I understand from it is that a younger person, a youth, has all these different things to distract them.
Yeah.
But they choose to go towards Allah.
Yes.
An older person has gone through these distractions. They've passed through it. Now they're sitting on their bed and, you know they're nearing their grave. So it's time to get into ibadah. But I do not believe that all old people are people who worship Allah. They're people who have changed themselves as they grew older and they started to understand the reality of life.
All right.
So obviously their ibadah now gains value because they have understood the purpose of their life, even if it's later in life. We're never late.
The thing is that you learn things, that's must, you know?
Yes, to learn something, even if it's later in life.
Even if it's later in life. That was such a good point. So even if it's too late, but the fact that you learn something and act upon
it's never too late in front of Allah.
Yeah, really nice. So, Fatima, let's come to you. You said that we come to know about the people. We get to know about who really is a real person, who is a fake person. There's this quote which says that, as you grow older, your eyesight becomes weaker.
Mm-hmm.
But the ability to see through people becomes very better.
Yeah, I think because of the life experience, and I think also depend on the childhood upbringing and different life experiences. But I think also I was going to add to what she was saying. I think also when there's like a big disasters, people start remembering a lot more and trying to understand why they're here. Like when the virus issue happened, like there were so many things online, people were like, oh God, oh Lord, when they didn't have any belief, they weren't practicing any religion.
Yes.
And they showed all the churches in Europe and US. Usually some people
even
go,
the former
but not
US
much.
President said
yeah,
that,
not much.
The
and they were putting all the candles,
Allah,
candles there and begging from Prophet Isa alayhi salam and Allah.
People coming towards and saying that open up the mosques, open up the church.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, it is COVID, but we need to open up church and mosque right
yeah, and
now.
Then now it's kind of calmed down. It's not as much a big issue. Everyone's back to the same way they were before, yeah.
Back to reality.
So, yeah. So, but yeah, I just think the older we get, we just kind of go through different life experiences. And then I think also I'm noticing too about a lot of cultural differences, like over here and in the East, people have a lot more stronger family ties. Like their emotional connection and attachments to their family is like blood family is much stronger than we have in the West.
All right.
So it's kind of like they always have, even no matter what disasters or hardships they go through, they always have their family, like their kind of like also Italian culture and these other Hispanic cultures, they have their, but their family always has their back. They always have their support.
Okay.
Whereas other people don't, when you don't have that, you're kind of on your own. I think you kind of start thinking more about like, I rely on Allah more and you're all turning right. to Allah more, yeah.
Stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. We'll be back in a short while.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
All right, Sadiqa, coming back to you. Do you think age has helped you to spot fakes?
We do learn how to differentiate between the good and the bad. You do learn that not everyone has decent intentions behind them. But then we are human beings and everyone is able to mask themselves very well.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm growing older and being able to differentiate between good and bad, the other person's obviously also becoming better at the task of masking their true self.
The task of masking, so exactly.
Yeah, so it's a two-way thing.
Mm-hmm.
So no, but at the end of the day, like as Sister Fatima constantly mentioned, is that we need to learn to rely on Allah and just in ask Allah to help us out when people are out with evil intentions for us. And
yeah.
we have these in the du'as as well when we recite them. Give bad to the one who wishes bad for me.
Yeah.
I myself have been in very bad situations. And, you know, alhamdulillah, I have been saved. And I think this is, again, because it comes from when you rely on Allah,
mm-hmm.
you will be taught through these experiences. But
yeah.
Still, there's always going to be that back support from God. And we just need to learn to rely while also keeping our eyes open. And, you know, like Allah says, he does not change the condition of the people unless they change themselves.
Unless they change unless they want that.
Yeah. So with reliance, we also have to use our intellect, which is one of the most important gifts Allah has given us.
Yes. Yes. So I have heard this quote once that to accomplish good, we must dream as well as act. So acting is an important task to do. Fatima, coming back to you, Sadiqa said that as we grow, the attempt to mask also, you know, the people who are really, really not good, they have this ability to mask themselves more. But sometimes even we do mask ourselves in order to think that we owe explanation to someone so that someone understands us. But do you think with the age, as we age, do you think we realize that I don't owe any more explanations to anyone? Like, whosoever wants me to accept this way, I am this way.
Yeah, I think also with the age, you kind of get more set in your ways. Like they say, after the age 40 on the Islamic calendar, your soul is complete. So you're not going to change that much unless you're like really, really work hard on yourself. You can, but you're kind of, your personality is pretty much 100% formed by then. So I think with the age above 40, you start really getting more kind of used to things the certain way. And you're not going to be as much, I think you don't become as bothered. Like I feel like when I was younger in my 20s, I was like more quickly upset and like emotional. And I'll just call my best friend Atava and be like, oh my God, can you believe it? What this sister said? And I was always so easily upset. And then I think now, since I'm a little bit like after 40, a little older, I just feel like, okay, you know, that alhamdulillah for everything. At least I have a place to live. At least I have, you know, I have a good physical health and, you know, and I just feel like after all these disasters too, especially the virus issue, I felt like so much more thankful. It kind of made us more thankful for health and for everything we have from Allah, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but I just feel like with the age, I'm not as sensitive and like easily upset. Like I'm just like, okay, that's the way it is. That's how it's going to be.
You know, there's one fact that whenever you ask a woman how old you are, she starts reacting or she starts minusing some at least, if nothing, at least 1 or 2 years.
Yeah.
Women never say their perfect age. Why do you think women are so sensitive about their age?
I think it's the societies, like I think especially in the West, even more than the East, but I think it's worldwide.
Yeah.
This whole kind of thing of like the woman's beauty is a certain timing. And then once she passes that, the aging, it's like you're considered, you're not, I mean, it's not Islamically, but like just in the societies in general, it's like you're considered your beauty is going to start going down the more you age, you know, whereas with the men, it's very sexist, but that's the worldwide culture. With the men, the more they age, it's kind of like they're considered to become more handsome. But for the women, it's like, okay, you're becoming like an old lady, you know. So
I don't see men becoming handsome. Do you?
But the culture, yeah, maybe they're not exactly, but the culture's kind of, at least in the West,
yeah,
they kind of imply that. So even though it's not 100% accurate, yeah.
All right. So women are actually concerned about their beauty. Well, you know, Shakespeare says in one of his sonnets that love is not love, which alters when it alteration finds. So I think a woman should never be cared about, like she should never care if her rosy cheeks are no more rosy cheeks. If her, because he says in the further verses that these rosy lips and rosy cheeks are not time's fool. So if someone really loves you, women should really not be concerned about aging. We are moving actually towards Allah, and we should always have this in mind. What is it that we are taking? I, as a woman, if I go back since what I have learned from aging, I will tell myself, stop being center of attraction for anyone, because these people are the people which Quran says in Surah Al-Qariyah that they will be the ones who will be dispersed in the air like moths on that day. So I don't need to be center of attraction for anyone. I should have this in this point in my mind that I am doing this journey step by step and heading towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Beautiful point.
Thank you so much, sister, for being with us. Thank you so much, Fatima. Thank you so much to our listeners. You are listening to IRIP English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan to send an inaugural flight of asylum seekers to Rwanda
has been abandoned after a dramatic 11th-hour ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Diane Taylor, Rajiv Sial and Emin Sinmaz. The piece is titled Rwanda Asylum Flight Cancelled After 11th-Hour European Court of Human Rights Intervention. Britain Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan to send an inaugural flight of asylum seekers to Rwanda has been abandoned after a dramatic 11th-hour ruling by the European Court of Human Rights. Up to seven people who had come to the United Kingdom seeking refuge had been expected to be removed to the East African country an hour and a half before the flight was due to take off. But a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights on one of the seven cases allowed lawyers for the other six to make successful last-minute applications. The decision is a significant and embarrassing blow for Boris Johnson and his Home Secretary, Priti Patel, who had promised to start sending thousands of asylum seekers 4,000 miles to the East African country in May. It comes hours after the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, threatened to take the United Kingdom out of the European Court of Human Rights and accused lawyers of aiding criminals exploiting refugees in the Channel. The legality of the Rwanda policy will be tested in a full court hearing next month. Responding to the decision, Home Secretary Priti Patel said she was disappointed by the legal challenge, made pointed criticisms of the European Court of Human Rights ruling, and said that the policy will continue. We will not be deterred from doing the right thing and delivering our plans to control our nation's borders, Priti Patel said. She added, our legal team are reviewing every decision made on this flight and preparation for the next flight begins now. Yvette Cooper, the Shadow Home Secretary, said the government must take responsibility for the failed flight and indicated that the government does not mind clashing with lawyers and the European courts. Ministers are pursuing a policy they know isn't workable and that won't tackle criminal gangs, Yvette Cooper wrote on Twitter last night. But they still paid Rwanda £120 million and hired a jet that hasn't taken off because they just want a row and someone else to blame. The flight, which cost an estimated £500,000 and had already been paid for from the public purse, a government source confirmed. The British government has paid £120 million as a down payment on the Rwanda deal. The government has declined to say how much it has paid in legal costs and has not said how much it expects to pay for future flights, accommodation and living costs for everyone sent to Rwanda. The European Court of Human Rights examined the case of a 54-year-old asylum seeker who crossed the Channel in a boat. He claimed asylum in the United Kingdom last month, citing danger to his life in his home country. 5 days later, he was served with a notice of intent indicating that the Home Office was considering deeming his asylum claim inadmissible and relocating him to Rwanda. A doctor at the detention centre issued a report saying that he may have been a victim of torture, it is understood. He was then served with removal directions to Rwanda for 14th of June 2022. A letter from the court said that the asylum seeker should not be removed on Tuesday evening, 14th of June. The European Court of Human Rights said it took particular account of evidence that asylum seekers transferred from Britain to Rwanda will not have access to fair and efficient procedures for the determination. The decision also cited the ruling by Mr. Justice Swift, who on Friday dismissed a request for an urgent injunction temporarily halting the flight. A statement from the European Court of Human Rights said an urgent interim measure was granted in the case of KN, an asylum seeker facing imminent removal to Rwanda versus the United Kingdom. The European Court has indicated to the British government that the applicant should not be removed to Rwanda until 3 weeks after the delivery of the final domestic decision in his ongoing judicial review proceedings, it said. Earlier, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, hinted again that the United Kingdom could leave the European Convention on Human Rights to make it easier to remove illegal immigrants from the UK. Asked whether it was time for the UK to withdraw from the European Court of Human Rights after the government's difficulty in implementing its Rwanda policy, Boris Johnson said, "Would it be necessary to change some laws to help us as we go along? It may very well be." In April, at the launch of the Rwanda policy, Boris Johnson has said that thousands of asylum seekers will be sent away and that the first flight would leave in May. The scheme has been beset with teething problems, Boris Johnson has admitted. The number of asylum seekers expected to be sent to Rwanda fell from 130 at the start of last week to 31 on Friday, and to just 7 on Tuesday, 14th of June. Most successfully lodged appeals claiming that sending those seeking sanctuary in the United Kingdom to an East African state with a poor human rights record breaches their human rights or that they have been victims of modern slavery. At a cabinet meeting on Tuesday, Boris Johnson also implied that lawyers representing asylum seekers are aiding human traffickers who charge thousands for journeys in dangerous boats across the Channel. "They are, I'm afraid, undermining everything that we're trying to do to support safe and legal routes for people to come to the United Kingdom and to oppose the illegal and dangerous routes," he said. He said what the criminal gangs are doing and what those who effectively are abetting the work of the criminal gangs are doing is undermining people's confidence in the safe and legal system, undermining people's general acceptance of immigration. Campaigners for refugee rights welcomed the decision and warned that the policy is still being pursued. Enver Solomon, chief executive officer of Refugee Council, said the government should have a grown-up conversation with France and the European Union about dealing with refugees, particularly in the Channel. "Those threatened with removal are people who have escaped war, persecution, torture and violence, many of whom have only been prevented from flying due to individual legal interventions declaring it a clear breach of their human rights to do so. The Refugee Council has also had to directly intervene to stop young people being removed to Rwanda because they were falsely assessed as adults. Government claims that this deal would act as a deterrent to end the model of people traffickers have already been disproven, with the numbers of people travelling across the Channel almost doubling on the same time last year. We always knew these measures would do little to stop desperate people making dangerous journeys to the United Kingdom, because they do absolutely nothing to address the reasons people come here.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.